Hello, I'm Rachel Hellier. It's August, and this month, for In Conversation with the Lancet Infectious Diseases, I will be talking to Dr. Paul Chapman, Infectious Diseases Physician at Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital, and researcher at Queensland Institute of Medical Research, Berghofer, in Brisbane, Australia. Paul is one of the authors of a fascinating study on a novel method of vaccination in humans, venturing into a whole new world of using attenuated worms for vaccination against parasitic diseases. Welcome, Paul, and thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
Can you start with a bit of background about hookworm infection and why you did this study?
So hookworms are actually a very common infection globally. There's probably 300 million people estimated across the globe suffering from chronic hookworm infection. And these little worms reside in your small intestine, and they attach to the mucosa and feed on the capillary blood supply there. And so amongst individuals with sufficient dietary iron and protein intake, these are actually pretty benign, and some people would actually argue they're beneficial for you. Amongst populations with high-intensity infection who have insufficient dietary intakes of iron and protein, they may develop iron deficiency anemia. And so this disproportionately affects communities, impoverished communities, and women of childbearing age, and anemia complicating pregnancy and delivering poor birth outcomes. And the result of that is that hookworm disease is right at the top of the macabre league table of neglected tropical diseases, and it's estimated that over 4 million disability adjusted life years are lost to hookworms a year, and it's projected that perhaps $1 billion US is lost in economic development due to hookworm infection. And it's been proposed that a vaccine against hookworms could be implemented as an anti-poverty measure, breaking the vicious cycle of disadvantage, trapping individuals and communities in poverty.
Well, so it's a really important subject to study then, and so it has huge implications sort of in terms of health and economically across some low-income settings possibly. You assessed a live attenuated hookworm vaccine in humans, so can you explain a bit about this technique? Explain how it's already used in veterinary medicine and what lessons can be learned from that?
There's already an existing animal model for what we've done. Back in the 1970s, for a couple of years, maybe 2 or 3 years in the US, there was a commercially available hookworm vaccine. This was a vaccine you could buy, which was very effective at protecting dogs against hookworm disease. And it was developed based on the work of Thomas Miller, who in the 1960s published a series of really meticulous experiments. So in these experiments, beagle pups were inoculated subcutaneously with radiation-attenuated hookworm larvae. So these were dog hookworm larvae that had been damaged or attenuated with an ionizing radiation source. And then 6 to 8 weeks later, he administered a subcutaneous challenge dose. So these are normal larvae that aren't attenuated to the vaccinated pups and also to a control group of pups. And in these experiments, they estimated vaccine efficacy by sacrificing the dogs and counting the number of worms present in their gut at sacrifice. And the results of those studies are truly dramatic. The challenge dose given to the unvaccinated pups was lethal in about half of them, with the pups that survived the challenge dose suffering from severe ankylostomiasis. So these poor little puppies suffered from diarrhea, weight loss, anemia, and were in very poor condition by the time they were sacrificed. And conversely, the vaccinated dogs remained really well and suffered only minor effects from their challenge. So these studies really gave us the blueprint for our investigation, and highlighted some really important principles that we incorporated into our study. And I guess the first or the most important thing that these animal models showed us was that it is in fact possible to produce experimentally induced immunity in animals to hookworms using an attenuated vaccine. And humans, although readily exposed to hookworms across the globe, don't produce immune protection due to hookworm infection. The second point was the degree of attenuation that you apply to these larvae is really important. So if you just inject dead larvae into these dogs, it was ineffective or less effective as a vaccine. And similarly, if you just injected live larvae, it was relatively lethal to the dogs. So the amount of attenuation was important. You needed the larvae to be affected by it, but not dead. Finally, illustrated in his studies and certainly our experience working with larvae also is that it's really difficult working with a live organism. Unlike working with a medicine or an inert substance or chemical, each batch of hookworm larvae differs slightly in terms of its infectivity, larvae's viability, and their radiation resistance. In the dog studies, it was really easy to control for this in that they had a control set of dogs, which they could sacrifice at the end and calculate infectivity, which obviously was not possible in human studies. In this case, we were very careful to build into our investigations internal controls. We were very careful to standardize our approach and to minimize the variables in our study as much as possible.
I'm quite glad that that you found another way to measure the level of infection in the humans than counting them in the gut.
Clearly important for the consenting process.
Yeah. You mentioned your control there. It was actually Tabasco sauce, which I thought was quite interesting. I'd quite like to know why you decided to inject Tabasco sauce in the control group, and also how you explained how you explained this to the potential participants as well.
So yeah, the participants were fascinated by this when I consented them for the study. But it was actually reasonably important. When you inoculate human hookworms, hookworm larvae onto the skin, they begin the process of penetrating the skin almost immediately. So within minutes, you can feel the larvae penetrating your skin.
Sounds like something from a horror sensation film, doesn't it?
It is, yes, this is a perfectly natural thing that occurs, across the globe in the tropics. And in people who are nutritionally replete, it's a benign infection. So, yeah, it was an interesting consenting process, introducing people to the concepts of hookworm larvae penetrating their skin. The first thing that you feel is this tingling, itching feeling, perhaps a burning feeling within minutes of the inoculum being applied. And then this persists for, some days, typically in low number infection. We really wanted to characterize these dermal effects closely. And so it was important for us to have an active placebo. Some studies in the past have just used a sham placebo, so the active arm gets larvae on a band-aid or a dressing, and the placebo group just gets some water on a band-aid. But very quickly, the experimental groups will unblind themselves or unmask themselves in the waiting room waiting for the study because, one group's itchy and one group isn't. So Tabasco sauce, when you hold it in close proximity to the skin for an hour, it produces an erythematous tingling, burning sensation. And so we used Tabasco sauce in this study, 100 microliters on a dressing applied to their arm for an hour. And it's a useful active placebo in hookworm trials. It has been used before, published before by one of my co-authors in a previous study, and some other groups have used other substances like histamine and so forth. We were actually really interested in the dermal effects. We were there's principally two adverse events that you can get from hookworm infection. One is the dermal adverse effect, or hookworm dermatitis, which is we've discussed the red, itchy lesion at the site of penetration. And the second one is gastrointestinal upset, often around day 20 to day 40 post-inoculation. So the gastrointestinal adverse effects are really simple to remove. You just give people worming tablets and those symptoms are taken away. But the dermal adverse events are more complicated or more difficult to treat. Although dermally applied experimental infection with hookworm larvae has been practiced lots in the past, and many hundreds of participants have experienced this, nobody's ever used attenuated larvae before. And no one's ever done a vaccination study using attenuated larvae. And so we weren't sure what would happen the second and third time people got hookworm larvae applied. We were worried that the dermal adverse event may become exaggerated, or even that it may become phenotypically different, for instance, like cutaneous larval migraines or the cutaneous symptoms that you get from zoonotic hookworm larval infection. So we wanted to control for this as closely as possible. In fact, as it happens in our study, we did see some evidence of this. So in the vaccinated group, following the second vaccination and following their challenge larvae, they developed areas of erythema and induration at the site of dermal application of the larvae. Whereas the placebo group, when they received their challenge larvae, the dermal effects were significantly less severe and just in keeping with what we'd normally expect to see following dermal application.
Oh, okay, yeah, so that's interesting to think about as well, those sort of cutaneous versus gastrointestinal effects and what you're sort of vaccinating against with the vaccine. So just moving on, so what are the particular benefits of vaccinating people against parasitic diseases in this way with the attenuated worms?
You know, what we're trying to achieve is control of hookworm infection. There's currently no available vaccine for humans for hookworm infection. And so the conventional methods of control rely on mass drug administration. So in endemic communities, people visit the communities every 6 months and give worming tablets to either every school child in the community or more recently to everyone in the community. And it's observed that by the time people come back to reworm the community, the prevalence and intensity of hookworm infection has actually increased back to pre-worming levels. So we need something that's better, some better strategy than the existing strategy. There have been some studies looking at more conventional vaccines that have been published. These are using subunits, single antigens essentially, and more recently published in this journal, two antigens together in a twin subunit vaccine. However, none of these have had a challenge phase, so none of them have had an active efficacy assessment. They've used surrogate markers such as humoral immunity development and so on. So many of our most active vaccines that we have today are attenuated live vaccines, the measles vaccine, mumps vaccine, rotavirus. One of the advantages of a live attenuated vaccine is that they expose our immune system to a variety or an array of different antigens at various times through the pathogen's life cycle. And it produces a really long-lasting, deep immune response through multiple effector organs, including the humoral immune system and the cell-mediated immune system. So we believe that the attenuation process in the larvae is affecting the larvae's ability to perform somatic migration. So this is the process where, and it's an incredible evolutionary story if you think about it, that these larvae can land on your skin, can penetrate your skin, travel through this universe for them, which is the human body, to the lungs, ascend through the bronchial tree, up through the trachea, and then be coughed up and swallowed, traversing through the stomach and ending up in the ileum and duodenum. It's really an incredible evolutionary story, and it's a marker or it's an illustration of how incredibly adapted these organisms are to us. We're suspicious, or we think or hypothesize that the attenuation process is in some place preventing this somatic migration of the larvae. In mice studies, there's a model of immunity to a hookworm-like worm called Nippa strongylus. So in mice, when you infect them with Nippa strongylus, they can be infected the first time, but when you try to infect them again, they've developed protective immunity. And it's been shown that this immunity probably develops in the lungs as a very important area. And indeed, that the immune phenotype that the mice create is a mixed response of T helper 2 cell mediated immunity characterized by interleukin 4 production. And that's actually very similar to what we've seen in our study with a mixed response and interleukin 4 and 5.
I also wonder if somewhat easier as well with the larvae sort of putting them on the skin than having to inject something, maybe practically on a practical level at the site.
Well, maybe. I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages, obviously. One of the disadvantages to working with live organisms is that they can have complicated shelf life properties and complicated storage requirements. And that was one of the reasons why the dog vaccine eventually commercially failed, and is one of the challenges that we have to overcome in the future.
On the topic of the future, what do you see in the future for this type of vaccination, and do you think it's going to be possible to use it against other helminths as well in humans?
I think we've achieved a number of things in this study. One of the most basic aspects of this study is that we've demonstrated, you know, a challenge model for assessing hookworm therapeutics. So if nothing else, this study has been useful to demonstrate platform for testing the other therapeutics in the future. Secondly, I guess we'd love to repeat this study with, you know, larger numbers, and that's certainly something we plan to do. This study was underpowered to find, you know, an efficacy outcome, as you'd imagine, and it wasn't designed to do that. And when we designed this trial, there was no data to guide power calculations for an efficacy trial. But now we have some of that data, and we think, you know, even a trial as small as 25 to 30 people could show efficacy based on the outcomes from this trial. There's lots of challenges ahead for scaling this up to a phase 2 trial. Certainly, you know, it's interesting that larval production methodologies haven't changed for 60 years. We're still using the methodology published by Harada and Mori in 1955. And really, this area of parasitology is ripe for disruption and technological change. And surely in vitro production of larvae is coming close in the future. And secondly, our method of attenuation of these larvae was to essentially bathe the larvae in UV light. And the UV light proposes attenuating them or damaging them, causing damage to their underlying DNA. But this is a really non-specific, you know, method of attenuating the larvae. And you can imagine now with gene editing technology, CRISPR-Cas9, we could produce an investigational product, a larvae that has been gene edited to arrest at a certain point of development. And this would be a much more reproducible and reliable investigational product than the attenuated product we're looking at. And I think to perform studies in the future, we need a few technological advancements. We need better parasitological endpoints. We continue to rely on eggs found in the feces under a microscope, or DNA intensity in feces calculated by PCR. And that's a surrogate marker of what we're actually interested in. What we're actually interested in is how many larvae make it through the skin, through the lungs, down into the gut. So we need a better parasitological outcome for further studies. So additionally, as I've already mentioned, we need a much more reliable solution for standardization of our larvae. So we certainly found over the course of our preclinical studies leading up to this that each batch of larvae would be slightly different. You know, one batch might be more virile and motile than another. Some batches would be more radiation sensitive than others. So we really need sort of like a point of care test where we can assess larvae in the field immediately before we inoculate them into a human. So all of these challenges we think are entirely achievable, and we've learned so much through designing and implementing this study, and we can't wait for the next phase, really. Looking forward to repeating the study with larger numbers in an endemic population.
Yeah, it sounds like there's lots of opportunities for improvement and to move on to the phase two study. So, yeah, I look forward to hearing about that in the future as well. So, yeah, thanks very much for talking to us about your study.
That's my pleasure. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks so much for speaking to me today, Paul. And thanks to the listeners for tuning in to this month's episode of In Conversation with the Lancet Infectious Diseases. You can read the full article in the Lancet Infectious Diseases online at thelancet.com. And you can listen to and subscribe to the In Conversation With podcast wherever you usually get your podcasts from.